Phronesis. Practical Wisdom with Scott Allen.
Hello, I am Scott Allen, and thanks to my daughter Kate for developing the intro to the Practical Wisdom for Leaders podcast, where we offer a smart, fast-paced discussion on all things leadership. My guests help us explore timely topics and incorporate practical tips to help you make a difference in how you lead and live. If you haven't done so, please click subscribe so you automatically, seamlessly stay in the know when we publish new episodes. Likewise, please provide me with feedback. What do you like? What do you dislike? And what else would you like to know? And now, today's show.
My guest today is Catherine Rimshaw. We are meeting for the first time, so you're hearing our first conversation. But I was just saying to her that she has been busy. She is an author. She is an educator. She teaches at UMass Lowell. She is in charge of learning and development at a software company. That's her day job. She's a TEDx speaker. She has her doctorate. You've got a lot going on, Catherine.
Yes, I do. That sounds so much more impressive than what my day-to-day agenda feels like. But that's a great intro. So thanks, Scott.
So I'm literally in the process of publishing a book now. And so I have great respect for kind of the journey you've been on. You published a book in October.
It was a long time coming.
You did. So I am so excited. The leadership decision. So tell us about it. Is there anything else you want listeners to know about you before we jump in?
No, I think you gave a great intro. I'm pretty excited about it. I live, I know I was just mentioning this to you, but I live just north of Boston, right on the Massachusetts-New Hampshire line. And I love it in this area, although it's getting a bit chilly this time of year and, you know, trying to keep warm by staying in the house and kind of running and snowboarding when I can. So those are my other two claims to fame.
Well, in your bio, it talks about craft beer, marathoning, and snowboarding.
I get to balance it all out.
When was the last time you ran a marathon? Are you still actively running all the time? I have great respect. I've done a half marathon. It was so hilarious because in the last, I forget what my time was. It wasn't worth noting my time. I was just happy that I did it. But as I was, it's so humbling because as I was running towards the, you know, finish line, you know, probably like a 70-year-old man passed me up, right? And then a 14-year-old young lady passed me up. They just kind of cruised past me. And so it's a humbling experience.
I think that's a great word for it. It's humbling. My marathon times are all like 4.5, 5. I think I've got like a 6-hour marathon in there. But I'm like,
hey,
I did it.
You did it.
Mind over matter, as they say. But good for you doing a half. So those are hard within their own right.
That's awesome. Well, let's talk about your interest in leadership. How did you come across kind of this passion for the topic of leadership and leadership development?
So when I was mentioning this to somebody earlier today, when I was in undergrad, I took a marketing class and I hated it. And I thought, you know, whoever gets into marketing, and not to offend any of your listeners who may be in marketing, but I thought, oh my God, I could never be in marketing. But when I graduated college, I had gone to college for a journalism degree. And then I realized what journalists made. So no offense to journalists either, because they do very noble work. But I thought I wanted to make a little bit more money. So I fell into marketing. And I worked in marketing for about 10, maybe 12 years. And I got to a point in my marketing career that I knew it wasn't for me. But during my marketing career, I planned a lot of like adult conferences that focused on healthcare and pharmaceuticals. And so really doing kind of adult education within the conference spectrum. And along the same lines, I started a master's degree, to which I thought I was going to start it for corporate communications and marketing. But Northeastern, where I got my master's, called me up one day and said, we don't have enough folks to run the program, but we have this really great leadership course. Do you want to take that instead? And I was like, what? Like, how on earth would anyone ever, never in my life at that point, when I was 23 at the time, had I ever thought about leadership being something you could study? Yeah, something you could study, a course, any of that. And I was like, okay, like I'll give it a shot, you know, and see what happens. And, you know, I was anxious to get a master's degree. So took the program, loved it. And then they, as I was finishing up the master's in leadership, the Northeastern said, oh, we've added a doctorate in leadership too. And I was like, sold. I'm in. Like, let's do this for another 5 or 6 years and see what happens. So I was working my marketing career and then kind of fell into the leadership stuff, if you will, on the side. And then eventually turned over to being in leadership development full time. And probably around the time that I started the doctorate and was beginning to finish up my research for my dissertation is when I began working on the book. So for about 7 or 8 years now, I'd been plugging away on it, you know, on the weekends and at night. And
it's a process. Well, I love Northeastern, and the current president, I might get this incorrect, Joseph Aoun.
Yes.
Is that how you say? Okay. So he wrote a book called Robot Proof, and it's just a book I absolutely love, kind of talking about education of the future and how we prepare students to be successful and with the future of work and where work mm-hmm. is headed. Great institution, great institution.
Yeah, it is excellent.
Doing some really
very
cool
much
things.
So, yes.
Yeah.
It's a great spot.
So 7 or 8 years you've been working. Well, I mean, obviously you were doing the research, but then and it's really around decisions. Let me see if this frames it up correctly. How the decisions that leaders make impact their personal brand.
You were right on it. Yeah. I wrote the book because I was seeing this very unique line between what academia says about leadership and then what people actually do in the working world and in their lives as leaders. So it was interesting to kind of straddle that line, if you will. And that's where I started to come up with a lot of ideas for my book and thinking about how can people be really practical in making the decision to say, like, yes, I'm going to be a leader. And then here are the next couple decisions I need to make in order to do that and develop myself. But then also still bordering a little bit, I'm going to say on the abstract, for lack of a better word, and thinking about how are you establishing a leadership brand similar to that of a corporate brand, which I think most people are familiar with, but then also aligning that to how you live your life and why leadership in some ways is a lifestyle. And once you make that decision to be a leader and to lead, you need to think about your life overall and what that's going to look like to your decisions and, if you will, like leadership practice. So
talk more about the leadership brand. I love that phrasing because each one of us have a personal brand, whether we want to admit it or not. When people think of us, they think of White Castle or a 5-star meal.
Totally. Yeah.
Right?
100%.
Talk a little bit about that. What did you find in some of your research?
The idea of branding as it related to leadership specifically was still that kind of merger of my marketing background with that of my academic and kind of personal interest pursuits. And I was like, I'm helping some of my clients develop a brand or kind of rebrand their organization. So how do we look at the elements that go into branding when you think about missions and reputation and perception that also merge back into how we can use some of that to define who we are as leaders and what we're known within our careers and how people perceive us and how they would kind of reflect on or kind of state our reputation. And I think that's where, you know, a couple elements came up that were really interesting in considering how people understand what their brand looks like to others. So perception is reality is a term that's been around forever. I don't even know how long that's been around, but something I talk about a lot in the book. And how a lot of times leaders fail to get feedback from others on how other people are perceiving their brands. And, you know, feedback's a bit of a dirty word. I mean, people hear feedback and they automatically think, oh, I'm in trouble. I've done something wrong. I don't have the time. You know, there's a multitude of associations that go along with feedback. But I think that was an element that I tried to touch on in the book was like, if you don't know how other people are perceiving your brand or understanding the value that it either brings or it doesn't, your reputation or brand as a leader is going to sink. And really trying to remind leaders, like it's a decision to start thinking or to keep thinking even about how you're getting feedback on your brand and using that to kind of self-assess and pivot as needed. So you're still known as a leader and can make better decisions to keep in line with that kind of goal, if you will.
I think about as you're speaking, I think about that even in the classroom, right? I mean, you teach And it's always, I was literally just looking at some student evaluations from the fall. And in some cases, that's people's people. That's your brand. That's a representation of what their experience of you right. was. While at times it might be difficult to hear, or it might be difficult to accept the fact that someone could perceive you a certain way, it's incredibly valuable. Because in some cases, it's just as simple as me performing some impression management at the beginning of class, right? Like, oh, he thinks he's all that. I didn't hear that in this most round. I have heard that in the past. Like, he's got a big ego. Oh, okay. So people can experience me as having a big ego. Interesting. Because I don't I don't perceive myself that way. So how do I manage that impression, or why is it I'm giving off that impression? And it's an opportunity for reflection, right? So I couldn't, I mean, I think it's great. I think it's such a great way of framing it, because as you know, when you were an undergrad, certain professors had certain yeah. brands, and they students walk into the room with that impression, right?
Totally.
And then you're either digging out of it or you're kind of living into it. And I think the same thing is very, very true with leadership, because that is it, the confirmation bias starts to take over. People only start to be able to see that thing that confirms their bias of, oh gosh, this is going to be a horrible class, or this is a horrible leader. I've heard they're terrible to work for. And you just start only seeing those things. That's hard for a leader to dig out of.
It is hard for a leader to dig out of. And I have my, you know, thinking back to the academia kind of point that you just made, was like, I have my students kind of self-assess their own brands. And that's their first assignment that they have to do at the beginning of the course. Like, hey, you've read a bunch of articles on what leadership is. What does that mean to you? So I define leadership brand. So I have hundreds of papers of students even defining this for me, which can make life very easy. But then two, what is your brand in relation to what you just defined? But the fun thing with that is that as they wind down the course, they then have to take how they assessed their own brand and then go out to three or four people who they interact with, whether it be at home or at school or their professional jobs, and get feedback. Would you agree yep. with how I've stated my brand proposition and mission as a leader to how you experience me yeah. each and every day? And some of them come into the class, and like you were saying, they think like, oh yeah, this is going to be simple. It's leadership. Like, this is going to be the easiest thing in the world to learn. And then they start doing some of that reflection that you had just talked about. And they're like, oh my gosh, yeah. like, this is a much deeper level of understanding that I need to do about myself and how this is impacting my life, how this is impacting my career, and where can I pivot to make changes that are not only going to benefit me at the end of the day, but benefit those around me and those who I'm leading. And it's just an interesting, yep. it's interesting to see where they are at the beginning of the course versus the end, once they've kind of had some of those realizations and feedback. So,
well, and what a great, I don't know, it's not a mindset, but it's a frame. What a great frame for them to begin their careers with. Hopefully they never, ever forget that. And if I'm consistently moving into the mm-hmm. workforce and understanding that I have a brand and a leadership brand, I have to imagine that's going to inform mm-hmm. behavior. I have to imagine that that helps people be a little more present with how they're behaving. Have you ever heard feedback from students as they've left the class and gone into the working world, or as they've kind of reflected on your course? Have you heard back from
a couple? I mean, you know, you teach that every so often that you'll hear from somebody that you had a year or two ago, oh, yeah. or maybe, you know, even further back, and they'll talk about, yeah. hey, I really learned X, Y, or Z. A couple of them have come back and said, I realized through the feedback that I had to get as a part of this final assessment from folks I was working with, that maybe I was kind of misinterpreting what some of my intent was as a leader. And this enabled me to go back and repair some relationships and make a difference. And, you know, some of them have some of those kind of standard reward experiences that they made a behavior change, they got promoted. Some of them, it was more that self-satisfaction of knowing that maybe they were able to rectify some behaviors or relationships, as I mentioned, that maybe had gone astray, and that was really helpful to them. So I've heard it from a couple, which is great. I wish I could hear from more on if that's made a true difference for them or yeah. not. But they do, I've received several notes that they felt like that was a really great way to end a course. knowing that they've gotten feedback that they can actually use, and it's not simply just for me as the teacher, quote unquote. So,
well, what were some other themes that came out of the leadership decision? What else do you, obviously we will put a link in the show notes so people can buy the book, but what are a couple themes that came through for you?
One of the things that I talk about, and for a while I cringed a little bit about, you know, how kind of not superficial that I wanted to be, and not that I'm trying to be superficial, but I talk about this other kind of component called TOL. And TOL stands for timing, okay, opportunity, looks, and likes. And I incorporated TOL because I thought, you know, now that I'm doing leadership development and talking to leaders at various levels, sometimes what I hear leaders say about other folks aspiring to leadership blows my mind. And like, this is where I cringe as I say this, although I just wrote a book and included this. So I guess I'm a little bit, it's a little bit ironic, but it would amaze me sometimes about how biased and superficial leaders are in judging and assessing other leaders. So that's why within that TOL model, I would still think about, you know, looks, and how sometimes I've heard really terrible things said by people because they don't see somebody looking a certain way as a leader. And I talk a little bit about the biases that we still have in mind as it relates to leadership. So not to insult any of your listeners, but I talk about the 40-year-old.
Catherine, you're going to have them all covered by the
through. I'm so sorry. But I talk about the I talk about the 40-year-old balding VP. And that's not to
luckily I'm 48 perfect. And have hair.
So we're set. I'm not insulting you. Like I said, I'm not. But I was trying to prove a point that, like, when we think about leadership and you even look at the stats, I mean, CEOs of major corporations in the United States are 50, Caucasian, you know, there's a large percentage. Yeah, they're all male. I mean, they're male. And yet this is where we see some of the movements in social causes that have come up over the last year or even last couple of years about, like, this is a problem. So why are we still basing one's leadership ability on how they look and still in keeping in mind some of these biases that we have about people, whether conscious or unconscious? Like, how can this still be happening? And yet we're still making decisions to enable these biases to thrive and carry on. And that's a problem.
I had Stephanie Johnson on the podcast, and then she spoke in my class before at the end of fall. And she said something that kind of stood out to me. She said, you know, there's more CEO Fortune 500 CEOs named, I think it was like John and Dave, than female Fortune 500 CEOs. And yes, I mean, it's a challenge.
It is a challenge.
Because I think organizations that are more balanced in their leadership are going to be more balanced in their products, in their deliverables, in the experience.
100%. And yet we know that, and research tells us that with diversity of thought, and I mean, there's so much out there on that topic these days. I mean, it's everywhere you look from a leadership standpoint, but the business publications are all talking about it. And yet it's still such a steady kind of theme that we see in the leaders above us and around us and that we help and coach, that there's really a problem with diversity. And I think that's a place that we can make decisions for ourselves and just being aware of that. But then also, you know, how do we take that awareness to a bigger stance to really start to encompass more diversity in hiring practices from the corporate standpoint, but even just having our own lens on our own bias of, you know, where we're misdefining what leadership is. So
TOL. So the first was looks, or at least one of the L's was looks.
Yeah, one of the L's was looks. The first is timing. And I think that's one thing too, that from the corporate standpoint that really appeals to me and thinking about my own career of timing of promotion or timing of knowing when to make a jump to a new job or timing when to take an opportunity versus when not to, because it could be damaging to my leadership reputation or brand, like we were chatting about earlier. And that can be timing is something that we can make decisions about, whether it's the right time or the wrong time to advance our leadership or to kind of stay put. Opportunity and kind of building on the timing angle was the O and toll, and thinking about how do we seize opportunities when they're given to us, but then make decisions to create our own opportunities to really enable us to practice our leadership and to be leaders, whether our organizations from a kind of traditional management standpoint are giving us that or not. Looks and likes are, like I said, the ones that sometimes feel, like I say, a bit superficial in terms of, you know, does what I look like actually matter to getting promoted or not, which I've got some horror stories there that I can say for another day about, like I said, people saying, well, they don't look like a leader, I'm not going to promote them, which has its own other set of implications and concerns. But then also likes. And like I said, that can feel a bit superficial too. But I worked for a leader when in my marketing career who didn't like me. She didn't like me at all. And she was pretty vocal about that. And I had reported into her and not into her and kind of back and forth for years. And when I wasn't reporting into her, I had leaders who were saying like, oh, it's time to promote you, you know, you're ready. But then I'd bounce back to her like, nope, you're not ready. You don't know what you're doing. You know, people don't like you. And she was pretty vocal about that to both me and other folks. Wow. And it was pretty damaging to my self-esteem and to the way that I even categorized my own leadership brand. And it wasn't a good fit. And once I moved on from her and that organization and was able to kind of rebuild my esteem and to really think about my leadership brand and renewing or reviving that, it was really eye-opening, because you do have, we all have horror stories of bad bosses or managers or cultures that we might have been in and made decisions to either stick it out for whatever reason or made decisions to move on. But I think about my own decisions that even enabled me to get in that position with her and what I could have, I mean, hindsight's 20/20, everyone always says that, but what I could have done differently from a career and leadership perspective to avoided that level of toxicity and situation with somebody above me in the formal sense.
And say a little bit more about likes. Is it, when you're talking about toll, is it, are these decisions for me to keep in mind as I'm thinking about my future? Frame it up for me a little bit.
I think the way that I approached toll was that toll is a model that we can all have in our back pocket, if you will, that if you're feeling stuck in your career or stuck in your leadership, that you can reflect back and say, am I making decisions in and around toll that are either hurting and hindering my leadership, or that I could be better capitalizing on to be a better leader? And that's where I was trying to find the dynamic, even with the story that I just shared of, you know, I know I'm not going to get promoted. This person doesn't like me. Why should I stay at this organization and have it hurt me from the psychological standpoint, from the career standpoint, and the way that I view and define myself as a leader? So I would say that wouldn't be something, you know, that a corporation would add to their kind of toolkit on how they instruct their leaders. But I do think it's a tool that my readers can benefit from and having a taste of reality for their own lives about why things may not be working or may be working and how they can really self-assess, keeping that in mind.
What's another piece of the book or piece of the research that stands out for you?
The skepticism or fear about leaders being vulnerable in their own right, and knowing when to be vulnerable and to allow their followership, if you will, to see that. And I talked a little bit about that in the book, because there was a quote I saw on LinkedIn maybe in 2014, you know, several years back, about a young woman posting about her CEO coming to a team meeting and kind of breaking down a little bit, and how she really felt like him showing that level of vulnerability helped to unite the team. Because he wasn't trying to put on the facade that some leaders do, like everything's all right and we're strong and we're going to get through this. But I mean, thinking about the conditions that we're in now with COVID and the virtual environment and people feeling emotionally taxed by this, I think that's a very wise thing for leaders to be aware of is that it's okay to show vulnerability, and it might be the one thing that you need to make a decision to show in order for your teams and your organizations to feel like they're not alone in what they're going through.
You have to be able to access that dimension of yourself. I mean, I love how you're framing that because, yeah, sure, there are times where being displaying confidence or displaying any number of different emotions or ways of being are totally appropriate for the situation. Vulnerability, yes. I mean, I've talked with a number of leaders in recent months since March 2020 who will openly say, I don't know the correct path forward. And I've said to those leaders, have you told your team that?
Yeah.
Because we're going to have to co-create this path forward. Yeah. No one person has the answer. No one's ever, at least that I know of, been through a global pandemic where we are now 90% working from home. It's new. And we have to navigate that together. And to your point, that requires some vulnerability. In fact, it seems to me from a leadership brand, it would be toxic to just barrel forward like you've got this all figured out and have everyone around you miserable.
I agree with you in that completely. And yet some leaders don't make that connection. And they think that by showing strength and only strength, that makes them a better, stronger leader and helps to support their brand and the reputation that they've built. But like you said, right now, we don't know, a lot of people don't know what they're doing and people are just trying to get by. And so having that very open dialogue to say like, hey, we're struggling, this is hard, isn't a dig, because we're all experiencing that at different levels, but it can be a way for leaders to connect in a different way than what they may have before, which like you said, can speak volumes for their brand, probably in the long term, than simply just showing that face of strength in the short term.
If you don't have that, you know, it could be spice in your spice cabinet, tool in your box, club in your bag, and you can't play that club well and know when it's appropriate to play it, I think you're limited.
Yeah.
You just are. And again, going back to the student feedback example that I'd given previously, all fall, I'm being vulnerable with my students saying, give me feedback. Let me know what you're enjoying. Let me know what's not the best, what we should do more of, what we should do less of, because we're learning quickly and I'm learning from them as to how they're experiencing all of this. Remote workforce, your team, it's no different. Had a great conversation yesterday with a gentleman named Dave Burkus, and he just wrote a book called Leading from Anywhere. And he talks about, okay, we're going to have to kind of negotiate as a team some of these new norms, and having that conversation, making that conversation explicit, whether it's something small like, hey, are we on camera, you know, during our Zoom calls, or what is it that we are going to agree to as a team, making all of that explicit, it's critical. That's critical. And again, that takes some level of vulnerability, because the leader has to say, I don't have all the answers. But I think there's a lot of people out there. Dave mentioned a statistic, you know, what is it? Gallup suggests about 3 in 10 are engaged at work. So that means 7 in 10 aren't. It's terrible that 7 in 10 people are going to work every day and not feeling engaged and excited and enthusiastic. Think about the wasted energy.
I can't even imagine, but it doesn't surprise me. I mean, I talk to friends, I talk to colleagues, and I hear some of them, they're still in it to win it, and they're getting through it, and they seem super engaged. And then some of them are sinking. It's like they don't know what to do, and when is there going to be an end to this, and how do I emotionally tackle this in a way that makes sense for my family and my career and myself, and really trying to navigate that balance.
Catherine, and we'll put this in the show notes as well. You've done a TED Talk, and it was about listening in part. And so part of being vulnerable is listening to others. Was there anything from the TED Talk that you could share with us as a teaser so people will watch
it? Sure. The story that I talk a little bit about the book was even in my own research. I did my dissertation on leadership development within healthcare post-reform, and some of the skill sets that were being institutionalized and taught through leadership development programs to really help better equip healthcare workers to navigate patient expectations and a multitude of things. And one of the practitioners who I spoke with she was talking a lot about how the program touched every part of her life and how it was just great, and that she felt like she was a better human, she was a better professional, she was a better family member. But then she specifically started talking about listening. And at that point within the research interview, I had started to kind of nod off a little bit. Not that she wasn't, you know, what she was saying wasn't valuable, but, you know, I'm taking my notes, like trying to get through it as researchers do sometimes when you've talked to 15 or 20 people and you're just, you know, it's another one to get on the docket. And she said, she goes, listening has been the biggest thing that I've gained out of this program. And I was like, oh my God, here this woman is talking about how important this leadership experience has been to her and her career. And I've started to drift off. And now she's talking about how important listening is. And I'm like, she must know that I had started to drift a little bit, maybe by the tone of my responses. And that always stuck out to me, because at no point ever had anyone ever said to me kind of so passionately about why listening is so essential to leadership and to good leaders. And she was so detailed in her explanation about how she felt like it, when she listens, it enables her to be more empathetic, which is true, and it enables her to connect more and to understand people different. But yet the irony in that is that most, I'm saying this because as I've done global training throughout the years, I always ask that question when I go across the pond, like, or even here in the United States, of how many times have people ever taken a listening course? And most of my participants say they never have. Normally, if I get people saying that they have, they've taken university over in the UK, which I think is interesting about why are people in the UK being taught how to listen and the rest of the world is not. But yet it's so, we know it's important. We know it's especially important in this virtual environment and being on the Zoom calls all day, but yet we're never taking the time to become better listeners kind of consciously, and how much that means now to kind of hearing what's not being said, even though you're looking at people through a camera compared to that of being in a room with them, and yet how critical it is. Yep. So that's what I did the TED Talk about, because I've had managers not listen to me, and I know how infuriating that can feel. And yet I heard from that particular interview subject years ago, and her story and kind of catching me not listening has just always stuck with me. So, but even now it's so important, especially being at home all the time and wanting to connect. So
it really is hard to do well in relationships, in all relationships, whether it's a spouse or a partner or children, friends, colleagues. I mean, you have to be present, and there's so much pulling at us in so many different ways, especially on a Zoom, where it's very easy for me to check out and not listen or not engage. It takes energy. It's not easy to
It takes a lot more effort than I think people realize to be a really present and good listener.
So, Catherine.
Yes.
As you think about, it could be something around leadership brand. It could be something around listening. It could be other than your book. What would you like to point listeners to? Are there resources that you've been consuming? It could be a podcast. It could be something on Netflix. It could be a book that stood out for you recently. Anything stand out for you that's really been transformational in how you think about leadership?
The thing that I talk about in the book, and going back to a little bit of some of the bias conversation that I've been thinking a lot about, is the Project Implicit Bias Assessment that Harvard put out years ago. That's one thing that I've been consulting people on internally about, and reminding them to, or encouraging them, or letting them know if they've never heard of it, to take that to even kind of broaden their awareness about their own biases. But speaking of Netflix, I did watch an incredible documentary that just came out earlier this week on death and dying. And I know that that's not the most fun topic to think about as we are in a pandemic and that's kind of surrounding us all of the time. But I'm trying to think about what the name, Surviving Death.
I had a really fun conversation with a colleague at a conference, an International Leadership Association conference. This might have been 8 years ago. We never did this work. But he was talking about how his mother had recently passed away. And we were talking about hospice. And I had recently had some interactions with some hospice nurses. And we had this idea for an article called "The Last Your Last Leader," because literally these caregivers are guiding, right? They're guiding the patient, they're guiding the family through this process. So incredibly difficult, but so loving and caring. And if, I just can't imagine that being my job. It's a special person that helps guide people through that, right? I don't know if that has anything to do with what this was about, but it made me
think. It did talk about hospice workers and some of the signs that they notice before someone passes away. But that was a thread within there about, I mean, with the topic matter, about what healthcare understands and what healthcare doesn't understand, what doctors don't fully understand about what really happens when you die. And I mean, you can take that from several different viewpoints, from religion to science to what have you. And the documentary did, it's a 6-part series. I don't know if they're doing a second one, it just came out yesterday. But that being said, it provides a lot of different perspectives from several different viewpoints about what death and life and passing on means, both from a medical standpoint to, like I said, a spiritual or religious standpoint. So it's a lot to think about, although it felt in some ways a bit heavy with a pandemic going on, but it was still a lot of good thought-provoking content. So that would be my somewhat fun one, because it's more of an entertainment one than Project Implicit, but those are my two big ones.
Well, the implicit bias, I think I took 3 of the categories. That was a really interesting experience. I'd never taken an inventory or an assessment quite like that. So I'll put the link to that in the show notes, because I think it's a really, really interesting resource. And I've never read any of the research that's associated with the work, but we all have biases. We all have biases.
Right.
Right. And that impacts us, and that can impact our leadership brand.
Can indeed.
Catherine, I wish you an incredible 2021. Well, best of luck with the book.
Thank you.
Be well. You too. Take care.
You too.
Obviously, Catherine brings forth a marketing lens to this conversation around leadership and adds a really important dimension. The practical wisdom here is, what's your leadership brand? And in my mind, just like we would design an intervention, a change initiative, just how we would design a presentation, just how we would design some type of leadership activity, I think our brand requires some design as well. And that brand has ramifications, good, bad, or ugly, for each one of us. So something important to reflect upon. What's your leadership brand? Thanks, everybody. Be well. Take care. And as always, thanks for listening in. You have been listening to the Practical Wisdom for Leaders podcast. If you liked what you heard, please share it with others and let them know what we're up to. And one last quick reminder to click subscribe so you know when we publish new episodes. And of course, we'd love to hear your feedback. You can stay in touch with me by visiting www.scottjallen.net. or any number of social media platforms. Be well, be safe, and make a difference wherever you are on this beautiful planet. And now, here's Kate's twin sister, Emily, with the outro.
You've been listening to Phronesis, Practical Wisdom with Scott Allen.